Lever. Agnes Nixon and Doug Marlin, who created One Life to Live, All My Children, and Loving, were nice people. The operating producer, the nuts and bolts producer, a man named Joe Stewart, was not. He would make young female actors weep. It was usually, "You're getting fat. You need to do your roots. You're breaking out." But it wasn't just women. Anyone summoned to Joe's office usually left shaken. Joe rarely showed himself on set or in the halls. You saw him, it was almost always in his office, and it was almost always bad news. He was the grim reaper of Loving. We were in the second week of shooting the show. We had done 8 shows already, and I was still without a contract. I'd been featured in the 2-hour premiere, so they couldn't easily replace me with another actor. It would be confusing to the audience. So I was in a rare position as a fairly inexperienced actor. I had leverage, and my agents were trying to use it to get me more money. I finished getting my notes after the dress rehearsal. 7 minutes before they called places to shoot the show, I was in the makeup room. Joe appeared in the doorway and asked to speak to me.
Gulp.
He took me aside. "We're having a difficult time finalizing your contract." He told me that the network's upper management was advising him to cut bait and recast the role. I was shocked. He continued, "Do with that information what you will, and have a good show." And with that, he turned and walked away. Have a good show? He was basically holding a knife to my throat. Have a good show. I was so intimidated that it wasn't until much later that I realized it was all calculated. Have a good show. He didn't want to pay me a dime more than he had to, so he was trying to get into my head and make me worry about my job security. It worked. I went to take my place on the set. My heart was pounding. I didn't want to be fired. I got through my scene distractedly. I called my manager the moment we were done. "I just got warned," I said. "Close the deal. Wherever you are, close it. I don't want to have that happen again." My manager said he thought we could get more. "Close the deal," I said. I was on the set contending with this, trying to work under duress in the real world. Managers and agents and sometimes writers operate in the theoretical world. The real world is a pressure cooker. I couldn't work like that again. I was sure of that. I ended up getting $600 per episode and then an automatic bump of $50 per show for the second season. The sweetest deal of any actor on the show. It wasn't because of my talent. It was only because I was hired last. I had leverage. Joe didn't love that, and I think he resented me for it. But after our run-in at the beginning, I rarely saw him. He never said anything to me. He was not a friendly guy. He didn't speak. He wanted to intimidate and be that man everyone feared. Every 13 weeks, the producers had an option to renew each actor's contract. In the year and 3 quarters I was there, attrition was high. We'd see auditioning actors in the hallway with scripts in their hands, and we'd try to see the names on the script so we knew our fates. If the actor resembled you, it was, "Uh-oh, a lookalike. It's gonna be me next. I'm getting fired." We got into the habit of calling the show Leaving because so many people were canned. Characters came and went. Patricia Callamber, the gifted actor who played my former fiancé, Meryl, was fired without warning. I blinked, and someone else, some hard-working colleague, had been dumped on the side of the road. No warning, no reason, just gone. I made it quite a ways. I had one more 13-week cycle before my 2-year contract was up. My manager, a wonderfully supportive man named Leonard Grant, called and asked what I wanted to do. I said, "I like having a job. I'm enjoying myself, learning a lot." "It's velvet handcuffs," Leonard said. "You've got to get out of daytime, or else you'll wake up and it's 20 years later and it's all you've ever done." He was right. We agreed I'd give notice. After 2 years, I was done. I made a plan to ride out 2 more weeks and then we'd let them know. My character was married at the time to Edie, played by Leslie Vogel. A nice woman, pretty. Though in the year we worked closely together, I never saw her without makeup. It could have been a complex shoot early in the morning, and she'd show up with a full face on. On a Friday, Leslie and I got called into Joe's office. "Have a seat," he said. We sat. "We've greatly appreciated your contribution to the show. Story-wise, we're going in a different direction. We won't be renewing your contracts." He stood up, meaning conversation over. It had been 10 seconds, maybe. I looked over at Leslie. Her face was frozen in shock. We stood. We'd barely sat in those chairs before we were up. Because it happened so fast, it was almost as if it didn't happen. I stood there. I shook his hand and said, "Thank you." It's like if you fall and someone sees you and you cover your embarrassment with, "I'm okay, I'm okay." It's not until later that you really assess the damage, your skinned knee, your bruised rib. In that office, I was punched in the face, and he didn't even bother to close the door first. He fired me, and I actually thanked him. Damn, I wish I hadn't done that. I walked into the hair and makeup room. I hadn't taken off my makeup yet from the day. My good friend John O'Hurley, we were both married to the same woman, Leslie, on Loving. He was sitting there, munching on an apple. He took one look at me and said, "What's wrong?" "I got fired," I said. He dropped the apple. "What?" I told him what Joe said, exactly. "We're going in a different direction." A palatable way of saying, "We're going away from you." I had tickets to see the Arthur Miller play After the Fall that night. I went, but I wasn't really there. When anyone since has asked me how I like the play, I say, "I have no idea." Despite very much wanting to see Frank Langella and Diane Wiest work, I only heard muffled sounds of actors on a stage. Even the cruel irony of the play's title was lost on me at the time. I was inside my devastation. I wasn't expecting to get fired, but it wasn't unexpected. We did call it leaving, after all. "You gonna be all right?" John asked. "I'm fine, I'm fine." Typical male response. But I wasn't fine. I licked my wounds in private. Saturday, I was filled with self-pity. Woe is me. I looked out the window forlorn. I was fired. I thought I was getting pretty good, but obviously I'm not, because I just got fired. I was getting angry. I was feeling terrible about myself. I had a couple drinks. I brushed my teeth and looked at my face and frowned and thought, "Poor baby. You got fired. Poor baby." And then I remembered the conversation with my manager. I was going to leave anyhow. 2 more weeks and I was giving notice. So why did I feel this way? It was sort of like I was going to break up with a girl and she beat me to the punch. I didn't want to be the one on the receiving end. I wanted to be the one in control. It was my ego. My ego had been hurt. The next morning I said, "You have got to get over yourself. Go do something." I bought 15 rolls of film and shoved them into my camera bag. I wanted to get out of my head. I walked into Central Park with my Nikon, but barricades were everywhere. The stupid New York City Marathon was underway, and now all these people were in my way and I wasn't going to be able to take pictures of the park. I started snapping anyhow. The first picture I took was of these two fat cops. They were huge. A sign for the runners was posted above them. It read, "Men this way, women that way." I took that picture. It was a pretty good picture. The motorcade carrying Mayor Koch and the race organizers and VIPs passed. The racers on wheelchairs flew by. And then the elite runners. Impressive. But I was even more impressed with what came next. A sea of humanity. A guy with one leg crossed the finish line on crutches. An able-bodied man collapsed 20 feet before the finish line, and a couple other runners picked him up and dragged him across the line. The scene was moving, heroic. I got chills. I was there 6 hours, taking photos of every kind of person. Each one of them had toiled and trained and endured and finished. I forgot my troubles. I forgot to eat. An old woman crossed the finish line. She was 83 if she was a day. She ran 26 miles. 26 miles! That was the distance from Long Beach to Catalina. How could anyone manage that? Let alone dudes in hula skirts and teens in funny antennae and a guy in full clown makeup and a waiter carrying a tray. Triumphant. Amazing. What the hell? How did they do this? I could never do this. I could never do this? I heard myself admit failure before I'd even tried. Another elderly runner hobbled across the finish line, arms overhead, victorious. I was 27. If I put my mind to it, why couldn't I do it? I couldn't think of a good reason. I vowed to myself, okay, next year I'm going to be in this race. That was it. I set a goal for myself. Without it, I might have pouted for weeks. Now, nothing was going to get in my way, except maybe actually having to do it. I planned to sublet my apartment in New York and go back to LA for TV pilot season, January through March, the time of year when producers cast new pilots for series that will, with luck, air in the fall. Before I left New York, I was invited to the Loving holiday party, and I went to say goodbye to all my friends from the show. At the party, I turned around and there was Joe, wearing an expensive suit and a smug look. He was standing there with his wife. He furrowed his brow and said, "Brian, I thought you'd be long gone by now, back to Los Angeles." Not "Happy holidays," not "Sorry about the way things turned out." I said, "Fuck off, Joe." Well, that's what I wanted to say. What I actually said was, "Nope, still enjoying the city. Merry Christmas." Oh well, at least I didn't thank him.